Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted path. Fortunately, Screencraft are here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures by your favorite writers such as J.J. Abrams and Tony Gilroy, to a daily blog with amazing advice. It's also no secret that Screencraft have the best screenwriting competitions around. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, Lionsgate, Universal, Blumhouse, Hulu, the list goes on and on of places that Screencraft winners have sold scripts to or have got staffed on shows at. So if you're an aspiring writer, don't wait to check out Screencraft at screencraft.org today. Follow the link in today's show notes to find out more and get your writing dreams started.
30 further you get away from a decade, there's the tendency to romanticize it. There are no good old days. There's no decade where everything was good and nothing was bad. And obviously, all the evidence is there if you choose to look. It's not like the darkness of the 60s is a surprise. It's just that people choose to forget. Some people choose to forget.
Welcome to Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies. Each episode, a brilliant screenwriter revisits their initial screenplay for what became a beloved movie, discussing what changed, what didn't, and why, from first draft to the big screen. Today we're delighted to be joined by none other than Edgar Wright and Christy Wilson-Cairns. Christy, you might remember from our recent episode on the fantastic 1917. Edgar, meanwhile, is one of UK cinema's best-loved blockbuster auteurs, the writer-director behind movies like Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim, and of course his Three Colors Cornetto trilogy with Simon Pegg. I could spend the next few minutes giving you my glowing appraisal of the pair's latest film, Last Night in Soho, which came out last week, but I think Stephen King said it best when he tweeted recently that this one is special, time travel with a twist. Last Night in Soho is many things. It's a horror movie, it's a time travel movie, as Stephen alluded to. It's also an ode to 60s Soho, and a brutal dismantling of British pining for the good old glory days that politicians and cultural commentators love to invoke. It follows Eloise, an aspiring fashion designer played by Thomasin McKenzie, who moves to London for uni and forms a seductive, supernatural connection to a girl in 60s Soho. It packs all the directorial flair and storytelling invention that we've come to expect from Edgar, and all the powerful drama and character detail that's becoming a calling card of Christie's. I spoke to the pair about how Edgar's mother's experience of the supernatural helped inform some of their storytelling decisions. We also talk about the infuriatingly still relevant issue of exploited women that sits at the heart of this story, and the subtle condemnation of Brexit that this movie may or may not have simmering under its surface. Now, just as a heads up, Edgar and Christy did ask that we don't delve too deep into the film's ending, as they want people to form their own conclusions about what's happening at the end for now. So this episode is maybe not as forensic about the final act of Last Night in Soho as we usually are. That said though, it's still a conversation as packed with spoilers as the Toucan pub is packed with punters on a Friday night. So before you listen in, be sure to get yourself to a cinema if you haven't already to watch Last Night in Soho. It really is an absolute blast. One quick thing before we dive in, and for a change, no, I'm not asking you to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or check us out on Patreon, though you're more than welcome to do both. This week, I actually have some really exciting news to share. Next Friday, November 12th, we're launching a brand new sister show to Script Apart. It's called How I Write, and well, basically, since Script Apart began, we've been inundated with emails from listeners who are screenwriters themselves, asking us to delve even deeper into the nitty-gritty detail of how our guests work. Like, how do they outline? How do they track their story beats? My personal favourite, what snacks does Aaron Sorkin eat when he's writing scenes? How I Write, which is presented by our friends at Arc Studio Pro, answers all of those questions and more. Well, apart from maybe the Sorkin snacks one. It's a series of intimate, up-close guides to how great film and TV writers go from outline to the finish line on their projects. We start with how they come up with story ideas and then begin journeying through how they devise characters, their approach to creating story arcs, the tricks and tips they employ to make scenes really come to life, and what they do when they run into obstacles. The first three episodes are out on November 12th, but because we're nice, there's a 5-minute preview that's included at the end of today's show, so stick around for that. Okay, I've rambled on for long enough. Let's get into my conversation with Edgar Wright and Christy Wilson-Cairns. Thank you so much to our Patreon supporters. That includes Tobias Hansen and Mark Cave. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demet. Edgar, Christy, welcome to Script Apart. Christy, in your case, welcome back. Huge congratulations on last night in Soho. I wanted to begin by venturing back in time to some key dates in the development of this project because, well, as we'll get to, there's a time-hopping quality to last night in Soho, so I figured it's only right. Let's start in 2017. Edgar, Baby Driver had just been this huge hit. You had the license to make pretty much whatever you wanted to do next. Why last night in Soho?
I think it was actually more towards the end of the year where I knew that it was the film that I had to make next because, you know, Baby Driver came out in 2017, but and this is not a bad thing. These are champagne problems to have. But I did like a year of press for that movie. And what's funny is that the most pressure that I got to do something else was the pressure to do the sequel immediately. But in that strange way, after talking about car chases for like a year straight, it started to kind of come to me that like, I didn't want to do like another car chase film straight away. Not to say I wouldn't do one in the future or even the sequel in the future. So Last Night in Soho as a project that I'd wanted to do for a long time, it started to feel like this is the movie I have to do next. And also having just had my first, you know, film that was set in America come out and do well, the idea of coming back home and doing a London movie was something that was very important to me, and doing a film in the UK that was different from the other ones that I'd already done.
And to jump back even further, I think I read that Last Night in Soho began as a playlist in 2007. Can you tell me about that and how the music of this movie kind of guided you?
I wouldn't say that it started with a playlist. It was more the sense that I had the idea for the story and I knew what I wanted to do. So I knew what the story was and I knew what the vibe was. And in a way, like amassing the songs for the soundtrack or even just songs to listen to whilst writing became like the post-it notes to remind me to make the movie. So I'd say like the songs were like, you know, the kind of stickers on the fridge saying, write Last Night in Soho. So anytime I'd hear one of those songs, like, you know, the Graham Bond Organization's Wade in the Water, or if I randomly heard on shuffle, like There's a Ghost in My House, it would make me think, ah, I have to make Last Night in Soho. So I'd say that they almost functioned like reminders in my brain to make the movie. All the songs like from that decade, they are like sort of, they're tonally in sync with the movie in the sense of what I like about a lot of the songs of the time is that they're sort of melodic and emotional and they always seem like they're sort of stained with tears. So especially from the female singers like Petula Clark and Dusty Springfield and Cilla Black and Sandy Shaw, like there's that kind of like huge kind of like sweeping almost melodrama about those songs and it really started to make me think about this film.
And do you literally write to those songs when you're actually sat down? Well, I guess in this case, putting together the outline in 2015, I think it was, did you submerge yourself in that music to kind of help you get the story on the page in outline form?
I think it was even before that, actually. I think the first time I started talking about it out loud to my colleagues like Naira Park and Rachel Pryor was in 2012. And I think I also pitched it to Tessa Ross, who was then the head of Film 4 around that time as well. It was before The World's End. But I guess, yeah, when you know, in terms of the structure of the plot, you could almost have little songs that are like pinned to the board like they're an index card in themselves. It's like this song goes with this section. And in a strange way, and this was not dissimilar to Baby Driver, if a scene is very visual, like it's more of a visual set piece than necessarily a big dialogue scene, then sometimes those scenes would sort of come to me like a movie version of synesthesia. Like I'd hear the song and I'd be able to see the scene in my head. I'm not saying that I have exactly the same supernatural powers as Eloise. It's that weird thing where like I'd hear the song and I'd be able to see the scene, like she see those visions in her sleep.
That original outline, this is before Christy, you came on board. How different was that initial outline? Were all the plot points in place as we see them in the finished film? Or were there other ideas that you explored and then abandoned for what could happen to Eloise, what could happen to Sandy?
No, the ending was always the ending. Like what it's building up to is always the kind of the final destination, not the movie. Because it is that sometimes people think like, you know, is it something where kind of like that was like something that you discovered along the way? It's like, no, I always knew where it was heading and what kind of movie it eventually becomes. And I do like the idea of like movies that are a slow burn from one thing into another thing. I think in this case, maybe it has like three stages, the three acts are sort of three sort of slightly different genres, but very deliberately. But then, I'm hogging this whole like talk. No. But when Christy came on board, I had the outline, which I think is very close to what it is. But then what did happen is that I think, you know, obviously the characters became more detailed. And I think actually, well, there's one key element that like Christy can speak to more, but basically, originally, I'd imagined that the 60 sequences would be silent, that they'd almost be like musical numbers. And then Christy made the point that like, for the film to work, you have to fall in love with Sandy like Eloise does. And that's very difficult to do if there's no dialogue. And so at that point, I think that's what was the biggest radical change, is that Sandy's part and the 60s parts became like actual scenes. And I don't think it was until that point that I'd started to think that Anya Taylor-Joy, who was probably the first actor I ever talked to about it 6 years before we like made it, that she should be playing the Sandy character and not the Eloise character.
Yeah, anyway, yeah.
Please let my co-writer speak now.
Yes. Well, Christy, I've been excited to ask you about your involvement. So I've read that you described the film as in part about the exploitation of women. And I'm curious to know, like, at what point it was in the process that you realized what this film was about and what the film was trying to say. Did you kind of just concentrate on telling a really exciting story together? Or did you kind of explicitly know the things you wanted to explore?
I mean, I think, you know, Edgar first told me this story before I was involved as a writer, just as a friend. On a night out in Soho, we sat in the corner of like this dingy little bar called Trisha's, and he told me the whole story. And I think, you know, the themes and that sort of resonance was already there. And it helps, you know, when you're being told the story by Edgar that he's a superb storyteller and incredibly gifted and incredibly empathetic. So a lot of those themes were like, you know, in the DNA of the story before I was ever even involved. And then when I came on to write it, I think, you know, when you're trying to write a horror story or a thriller, when you're trying to create something that's genuinely scary, it's useful to use quite scary things. and the exploitation of women and, you know, the sort of like the danger that lurks for single women alone, I think is very frightening and touches at least 50% of the population. So I thought those very dark notes in it were absolutely integral to make something that felt honest and felt truly scary.
Yeah, and crucially, it's not a period piece. Like, it's not a case of the 60s were bad. Thank God things are better now. There are kind of hints in the script that allude to the reality that we live in today that we've all been reminded of course, in the last couple of weeks. In terms of other stuff that's kind of simmering under the film potentially, this is a movie about a glamorized piece of Britain's past, 1960s Soho, that kind of culturally there's a lot of nostalgia for, but in reality, as your film uncovers, had a darkness to it. And like Last Night in Soho, I know kind of existed, it predates Brexit, but was there anything about the national mood over the last couple of years that either of you consciously or subconsciously perhaps kind of poured into this intrinsically British movie?
Well, I think what's funny is I think the night that we went out on our Soho bar crawl was the night of Brexit. Was it the night,
yeah,
or the night
no
after?
Way. Like the night of, I'm sure. And we were drowning our sorrows. We were distraught.
As diehard Remainers, we were drowning our sorrows. And I mean, I think the truth is, the sad thing, and this probably speaks to the other theme in terms of like the themes in the movie about kind of the treatment of women in the 60s and the modern day, like, it predates, you know, other recent movements, because the sad truth is it's been going on since the dawn of time. Mm. And in the case of the Brexit thing, I mean, this is now the third film that I've made that people have either said is a Brexit indicator or said that like the world's end was a premonition of Brexit, and that Gary King in his infinite wisdom, tells the network to fuck off, and then they withdraw from planet Earth and lead us to chaos. And I was like, yeah, I guess that sounds a bit like Brexit. in this case, I think it wasn't intended as that, but people have been using the word the good old days, you know, for like sort of since, I don't know, when did they start using the phrase the good old days? People in the Stone Age kind of sort of, or people in the Bronze Age say like, oh, it was better back in the Stone Age. I don't know. I mean, I think the thing is, I mean, is that the further you get away from a decade, there's the tendency to romanticize it. And it's not like, obviously, there are no good old days. There's no decade where everything was good and nothing was bad. And obviously, all the evidence is there if you choose to look. It's not like the darkness of the 60s is a surprise. It's just that people choose to forget. Some people choose to forget. And I think that's the thing. And even in a way, I think the other thing is that the sort of the dark side of the 60s is also romanticized. The criminal underworld, even the sex industry, there's an element where that in itself becomes kind of glamorous, even in a salacious way. And so that's something that I always kind of found fascinating. And, you know, one of the first things that I did, even before Christy came on board, once I'd had this first meeting about it as a potential project to develop, is we hired this amazing researcher, Lucy Pardee, who's also a BAFTA-winning casting director, to research every aspect of the script. So I sort of like, I knew what I knew just from what I'd read in literature or seen in kind of TV and films or like, but I still wanted to get some sort of further research done. So pretty much every like facet of the script she researched, with a lot of like testimonials from people who lived and worked in the Soho in the 60s, live and work in Soho now, even like, and then encapsulating everything that's in the script, kind of like students coming to London. I mean, me and Christy have our own separate experiences of being from outside London and coming to London. You know, I have an art college like background. My sister-in-law is from Cornwall and went to sort of study fashion at art college. My mum like also kind of like sort of studied fashion. Like Christy's mum and grandmother both have a sort of a background in like, you know, making clothes. So there's all these autobiographical things come into it and all of this research. So when me and Christy met to actually write, when I asked her to write the script with me, you were met with a wall of index cards and this research, right?
The office was like, and Edgar was nervous when I was coming in because it looked like a serial killer's room, like, you know, or like someone trying to catch a serial killer, but definitely a blurred line. But that's my aesthetic, so it was fine. I was like, this is what my house looks like, so that's totally normal. And then, yeah, like a tome of research. And also, of course, the playlist. Yeah. Playlist for the film, which was really, as a writer, like coming in, so lovely because it just gives you the kind of the tone, the pace, the kind of the structure there. It was so kind of like, I suppose maybe people would feel like it hemmed them in, but for me, I found it incredibly freeing to be like, oh, this is the songs we're using.
Mm-hmm. And when it came to that point, like writing together and translating this from like an exciting outline to like a fully realized movie, what was the process for you and what were the big challenges?
I think the interesting thing for me was just that, you know, the first thing is having had this in my head for a long time and having had it mapped out as I saw it, was running through it all with Christy and then hearing what she had to say and what she thought it needed. And those are all things that kind of changed the movie in, you know, huge ways that like, I you know, sometimes you can't see it from in an objective way. And then I think a lot of it was like, we're bringing more of our own stories into it. And I think there's probably sort of, you know, we have, you know, kind of come from different areas of the country, but it's weird how similar some of our stories were in terms of that there's bits in the movie that kind of feel like both of us talking at the same time.
Both,
right?
Both our lives. Yeah. I mean, we had so much in common with just this idea of like being young and moving to London to pursue a dream that's slightly impossible. Pretty much mostly impossible. And so like that just felt like such a thing to me that felt so universal, but at the same time, intensely personal. And I mean, like the lovely thing about writing with Edgar is, well, first of all, he's a really nice person. He's a lovely human being. We get on very well. So like, that's always a joy. But it's like sitting down and then going through everything and knowing that nothing's too precious. Like, we've got such an amazing foundation, and like just build and build and build. And I can even see like stupid suggestions, because like they can grow into, with his brand of magic, something quite unique and maybe useful. So yeah, it was just, it was like 6 weeks we spent on the first draft, like sitting in a room, talking about the characters, eating some Rebels, being judged for how much Iron Brew I drink, you know, totally normal writer's room.
Iron Brew, Scottish Tizer.
For our American listeners, Iron Brew is.
For the American listeners, it's basically both Tizer and Iron Brew are like sweet tasting battery acids.
Delicious.
And the $1 million script apart question, how did that first draft compare to the finished film? Like, what were the changes that happened after that first draft?
I think the general structure of it is remarkably similar, isn't it? I think we just kept kind of adding detail. I mean, another thing that didn't exist in my outline, which was Christy's suggestion and a very autobiographical one, was the idea of Eloise being short on funds as a student, obviously, and getting a job and having like a sort of another location, you know, that she's in retreat, because like she's too proud to tell her grandmother that things are going bad, that things went badly enough in London that she left her halls of residence within a week. So then the idea of going to a new place and having to pay for that, and the deposit being high, and having to supplement her like sort of like loan, that she works in a pub. And so we picked the Toucan, in which Christy Wilson Cairn worked for 5 years.
Yeah.
The best pub in London. Not that I'm biased. No, we picked that. And I think, I mean, that also grew out of the need to have, like you say, another location, but from a character point of view, like another place to be at night. Like somewhere to hide out at night. And like, you know, as a poor student who couldn't afford Netflix, like the pub for me was somewhere to hide out at night and pass the hours and not pay for heating in the winter. and I think like when you take those sort of like small things and you think, well, what if I was like genuinely terrified to go back to my flat? Like, where would I stay? Where would I feel comfortable? And like one of my favorite sort of like little beats in the film is when Carol, the landlady, says to Ellie, you fit right in, but you can't sleep here. And then turns out the light. And then that lovely cut that you've got. I remember when you told me about that cut when we were writing it. And I was like, oh, because I love like, see like a strong cut. Because you know, when you're just a writer on your own, you can't necessarily be like, oh, I know exactly what I'm going to do. Like this cut. Because you're not the editor. So you're like maybe leaving kind of treats. But when you're working with, when you're writing with the director, and they come out with these cuts, you feel such a build, such a sort of like sense of motion in the script that's like electrifying.
Hey, this is Al. Just jumping in to tell you about one of our great sponsors this week, We Screenplay. Making progress on your screenplay can be an incredibly isolating experience. You've completed a draft, but what next? That's where We Screenplay comes in. Not only does We Screenplay have amazing free resources like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, they're also the industry's number one script coverage service. Looking for notes on your short script, TV pilot, or feature film? With incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback that's tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their career. From folks writing their first script all the way to Oscar winners and longtime producers. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings, hands-on workshops, and once-in-a-lifetime learning opportunities that We Screenplay has to offer. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay are here to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. And to dive into some of like the important beats in the film, like Last Night in Soho begins with this striking image of Ellie kind of silhouetted in a doorway. And that kind of then gives way to this beautifully stylish scene in which she's dancing around her bedroom. As an introduction, it communicates so much of what this character is about, the world she inhabits and how she moves through that world, which is a trick that you also pulled in Baby Driver, Edgar. Like both movies begin with a character listening to a song as a window for the audience into who they are. I'm curious to know like what you love about those openings, Edgar, and for the both of you, whether this was always the opening scene for Last Night in Soho, whether there were other ways of, yeah, sort of introducing this character.
I don't remember there ever being another opening to it. Yeah, I mean, even that opening image was something that I just, I think it was that thing of just that, I mean, I guess the whole movie is about the difference between perception and reality. The whole movie is about her perception of the 60s and the reality of it and, you know, and having to kind of like manage that. And in a way, that opening image is like you, the first image of you see her silhouetted in the door with what seems to be a fancy ball gown. And then, you know, you switch on the lights and she's in a cottage in Cornwall and she's wearing a newspaper dress. So I guess like in terms of like that thing of like your Robert McKee opening image thing straight away is like you've got the kind of the glamorous image, but then the kind of maybe more mundane, disappointing reality. It's funny, some people actually say about the opening scene, which I like, is some people don't realize that it's in the modern day until she gets on the train and when she's wearing Beats headphones, because the opening scene, Cornwall, there's not really much in the cottage to indicate that we're in the modern day. You don't really see her with a smartphone. The only thing would be the envelope from the London College of Fashion. But it's funny, like somebody said at a screening said, oh, it wasn't until I saw her with the Beats that I realized that we were in the modern day section. So I guess that was always the idea of just being, and also I think the thing is that thing that I think a lot of people have when they're growing up is that when you get to 18, you're sort of like sometimes you're the sort of king or queen of your own domain, you know, like the sort of like the kind of like in your bedroom, you are in charge and this is your little kind of kingdom. But then, you know, as soon as you're outside of that, I mean, what breaks my heart watching it, because Thomasin McKenzie is so good, is how confident and lively and sure of herself she is in the first like 5 minutes talking to her gran, and how immediately that gets kind of like taken away as soon as she gets to London, which I think is something that a lot of people have that, you know, like I thought, you know, when I was 18 and living in Somerset, I think I had this delusion that I was somehow the Fonz or something like that, until you actually go to a bigger city with people who are either richer than you and have more contacts, or poorer than you and therefore cooler. Like, sort of like you think like, oh God, there's no way I can possibly make a mark in London. I don't know anybody. I've got no money. I'm also middle class, and somehow that's the worst. Like, so it's, I feel like that imposter syndrome thing and the idea of being the country mouse is something that like has never gone away. I still feel that kind of like, you know, anxiety of being an imposter at all times.
Yeah. It's really...
the question, I have no idea.
Very good answer. I loved it, personally.
It's then very quickly established that Ellie has a gift. Like, we see her mum in the mirror, and very swiftly it's conveyed in her conversation with her gran that this is something that threatens to overwhelm and endanger her. So much so that she lies to protect her gran from worry. She says that she hasn't seen her mom moments after we as an audience see her. So we should talk about Ellie and her gift. Like, or from another perspective, it's a curse. Like, you know, I'm curious to know how you arrived at this idea of a girl who could see past lives and how you guys approached how much to explain about what her power is and what the rules for how it works are.
I didn't want to like over-explain it, because I think it's something where people talk around something. Like, to say a gift is like a very nice way of saying it. And I think the thing is, I mean, here's the truth of it, is that me and my brother sort of grew up in our family house, and my mother's always been somebody, a bit like Eloise, who I would say is like supernaturally switched on, in the sense that she would say that she would feel presences in old buildings, or even feel presences in our family home, and sometimes like literally see ghosts. And growing up with my mum, like, it wasn't something where I rejected those ideas. If anything, I was envious that I hadn't seen a ghost. And maybe it was a young horror fan. I was definitely like sort of open to the possibilities of like the idea of it, and never like a skeptic. But obviously, in those situations, like, you share those stories with some people and not others. I didn't go to school and saying, hey, my mum saw like the ghost of a hanged man in the living room. Because they'd look at me like I was crazy, let alone what they would think of what she'd said. So it's those things that have then become kind of personal, or that within the family, you're talking around it. It's also that thing in terms of, you know, later in the film, when the suggestion of mental illness comes up, you know, we leave that deliberately ambiguous, because as far as I'm concerned, Eloise's gift is a gift. But from an outside perspective, like in a later scene in the film, if you went into a police interview room and said, I witnessed a murder in 1965 in my dreams, they would look at you like you're crazy or that you have some issue. But, you know, so basically, in terms of, to answer your question as well, my feeling is that she's almost like sort of an emotional wave rider in the sense of what she's picking up on is the sort of psychic residue of events. Mm. And that is some, you know, sort of becomes visual in the sense of seeing kind of spirits and then also kind of embodying like sort of people who have been in that room and going on a journey with them. And I think that's something that people who are like that, there are lots of different ways that you can have those experiences. You can physically see something, you can feel something. In your dreams, you can feel like you are somebody else, that you're like embodying. And that's something that I certainly have had those dreams. I know lots of people do, where it's like, I am somebody else and I'm sort of going on an adventure in a different body. Christy. Sorry, I felt at a certain point I was revealing too much about myself.
I was leaning in. I just remember when we were first talking about this, because we discussed this loads, like how much do we believe, how much we want the audience to believe, because it is such a sort of like, you know, linchpin of the film. And I remember you telling me about your mum and then also showing me the spooky goings on, which is like, was it the stuff that your mum had written and sent to us, which was like just her experiences. And that totally unlocked it for me, because I was like, oh, because I'm, to be perfectly honest, probably a non-believer when it comes to ghosts, although come show me I'm wrong, spirits, please, lottery numbers. But yeah, I think it was really integral. And also with any of that stuff, we can't explain more to the audience than the character knows, right? Mm. And Ellie doesn't know. She's got a feeling, she's got a vibe, but she couldn't say for sure one way or the other. And also at 18, you'd be too afraid to say for sure one way or the other. You don't feel like that confidence to be like, oh, I'm very different from all of you guys. And so I think whenever it comes to something like that, like let the character inform your decision as a writer. Like how much does the character know? Okay, well, then the audience will never know more than that.
And also she's not going to let this issue stop her. Mm-hmm. So that's why she lies to her grandmother. And then that becomes kind of like a thing throughout that's actually sort of stopping her from telling people what's actually going on, is a sense of pride that I'm not going to let the city beat me. There's that theme throughout of like people like warning about the big city, and London can be a lot. But Eloise, even with everything that's going on, still doesn't want to be defeated by the city itself. So she keeps kind of plowing ahead at a point where other people would like, take a break, go back home, get out of the house. You know, there's something where she sort of, she doesn't want to be defeated and she doesn't want to let her grandmother down. Like that's the first lie that she tells in the sort of like the second scene, is that like, you know, I haven't seen mum in ages, when the audience knows that she has. To me, it's not that she's unbalanced, although maybe we keep that ambiguous for a long time. It's more that like, if you have these visions at home, what is it going to be like going to a big city where there are, as we lay out, a lot of ghosts?
Yeah, I think one of the other things I love about that opening scene and everything you establish is Ellie's mum is dead. And that kind of does two things. It kind of establishes a sense of danger and stakes into the story. This happened to her mum, and now Eloise is embarking on the same path, potentially. It also seems kind of rooted in character. Like she has a timidity and like a quiet woundedness that potentially sort of stems from losing her mum. Another thing I'm curious about, I mean, we've touched on it, Ellie kind of leaves home and has a really hard time adjusting to London and to this nightmare course mate, Jocasta, who, I mean, I've had to really rethink my relationship with my old university roommate who used to blast the German metal band Rammstein at 4 a.m. every morning. He seems fine now compared to Jocasta. It feels like all this material in the first act is really crucial for understanding why Eloise would be so mesmerized by Sandy and so drawn to her glamour. Can you tell me about like setting up that journey that she's going to go on with Sandy, at first seduced by the character, then kind of like dangerously submerged and unable to extract herself from the nightmare of her story?
Well, one thing I should say about Jocasta is that the name comes from that my, I keep bringing this back to my mum, but I guess she has a huge influence on this movie. My mum told me and my brother, Oscar, what we would have been called as girls. And so my brother is called Oscar, so it's Oscar and Edgar. But if we were girls, we would have been Jocasta and Chloe. And Jocasta was named after the habitat designer, Jocasta Innes. So it's like one of those names that's just stuck in my head. I think I probably would have been Chloe and my brother would have been Jocasta, but it's just one of those names. Like that. I've never met a Jocasta in person. I never met Jocasta in it. So I've never met a Jocasta. So, you know, when she says that line, how many Jocastas do you know? She goes, none. She goes, exactly, babes. It's like, I've never met a Jocasta. So that was very easily the, and I felt as well, when I went to art college, I didn't stay in halls of residence. I went to Bournemouth and I stayed at like an out of town B&B, but I immediately felt outstripped by my hard partying, like sort of, you know, kind of, I actually think I had a single room. I never shared a room, but like everybody was like, sort of like much more into kind of not Rammstein, but like rave music and stuff, which I wasn't really into at that point. I guess the central theme of it in terms of even beyond Sandy is like, and this is sort of what the movie's about, is if you're so obsessed with the past, and I am obsessed with the past. I was born in 1974. I'm very obsessed with the 60s. And I think that starts with my parents' record collection. And I have had time travel fantasies about going back to the 60s, or just the idea of like, wow, wouldn't it have been cool to be in London in the 60s? But then the more that you think about it and the more that you dream about it, and then even start to get bogged down in practical problems involved in that fantasy, like, what if I went back to the 60s and I didn't have enough money? Oh, or I didn't have the right money. You know, like I got all my mind's in decimal. I got the wrong money. Or I have to go back and foil an assassination, but I can't remember when it is. But then as you start to think more and more about it, then it's like, am I spending so much time dreaming about the past because I cannot handle the present? And I think that's basically what Eloise is doing, is that dreams about going back to the 60s, and she's grown up with her grandmother, literally Rita Tushingham. Like, so her grandmother was around then and has these records. So she's become obsessed with the decade through her. And then she gets to go back. But in a way, what's really happening is she's failing to deal with the present. So going to the halls of residence, meeting all the horrible roommates, and then retreating first to like a bedsit and then into the 60s. Is her failure to, it's a retreat. She's retreating from the modern world. And like you said, at first it's great and glamorous. And Sandy is somebody to, you know, want to be. And then as Sandy's journey takes a tragic turn, she can't get off the roller coaster.
It's interesting, as Sandy's relationship with Matt Smith's character kind of develops and grows darker and more violent, we're led to what we interpret as the audience as being the murder of Sandy. That, of course, turns out to be a really clever misdirect, and, well, we later get a very surprising reveal. I know you're hoping to let listeners come to some of their own conclusions about the end, and you don't want to demystify things too much. But what can you tell me about the final act twist and, yeah, some of the thought processes that led to it?
Well, I guess, you know, within that genre of like psychological thrillers, and especially, you know, the giallo films, you know, named after the yellow paperbacks they used to sell in Italy, like mysteries and thrillers, there's always that idea of like the difference between the lead character's perception of something and the reality. And that goes to like, you know, so many classic movies, like Psycho is obviously a great example where, you know, there's a scene where Marion Crane witnesses what she thinks is a conversation between Mrs. Bates and her son. And you hear it all kind of like played out, and it's like, you know, it's, so it's like a big red herring, but it's what she believes is the real reality of the situation. And so does the audience. So there's lots of films that I love that kind of where your perception of an event becomes something else with the real context. And then I think beyond that, the thing that I really liked about this is because Eloise is going back in dreams only. And this was something that we had sort of fun with writing, is that there's a lot of information lost in the ellipses, in the sense of like, she has a dream one night and then the next night she has another dream, but you don't know, for example, in the two Rialto scenes, the scene where she does the audition and the next scene where she's one of like, you know, six showgirls, you don't know how much time has passed. You don't know whether it's the next night or it's 6 months later or it's a year later. In the next scene, like, is this like a couple of weeks later or is this 2 years later? It's unclear, because like she's, like I said, she's just sort of riding these kind of waves of like sort of high points of emotion, but does not have the entire life history to be able to pass it out. And then that kind of like that sort of key event is something where what she witnesses is like half the information. And at the point where she would have seen the sort of the key moment, she sort of chooses to shield her face, and also somebody walks into the room and bathes it in light. So it's almost like the vision gets interrupted. But what she thinks she's seen is one thing happening, but what she, you know, then later realizes was something else. So she's kind of like, so in that sense, she's an unreliable narrator in terms of she's seen the events, but doesn't have the full context.
Mm. And the way we end the film is so special. And I know that, you know, you don't perhaps want to, you want to be careful in how you discuss the ending, even though this is a spoiler conversation, you want people to interpret it in their own ways. But one thing I will ask is we leave this story, there's the possibility of continuing this story with Eloisa applying her gift to other murders as a fashion designer by day, cold case detective by night, potentially even assisted by Sandy. We see her at the end of the film.
Oh, I like this idea.
I know. You're here's my pitch, Randall, right?
And Hot Kurt deceased territory.
Yeah. I know that, like, for both of you, like, your priorities don't traditionally lie with sequels. That's not something you've explored before. Although, of course, as you mentioned, Edgar, you have written a Baby Driver sequel. Have you thought at all about continuing this story? Is it a world you'd like to step back into, or do you feel like you've done with Last Night in Soho?
Not until this conversation right now, but as you say it, maybe if the sequel's in a different genre and it's like sort of actually like, it's more like a Devil Wears Prada type, maybe. Yeah. It's like a sort of fashion story, and Eloise is rising the ranks in the fashion world, but like, so her secret is that her kind of like basically her assistant is a ghost.
a bitchy, oh, I can't spoil it, a bitchy murderous ghost telling her how to navigate the hard kind of magazine world of Vogue.
Oh, I'm in.
I'm in.
And every solution's always like, have you thought about killing them?
Well, no, she would like, yeah, it would be, imagine it's like Working Girl, and like if Eloise is like the Melanie character, but then Sandy is whispering and is saying, just kill Sigourney Weaver. Nobody will know. I got away with it for years.
Okay, that's that greenlit. Well, guys, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for this film, and thank you so much for chatting for me today. This episode has been brought to you by Iron Brew. It hasn't, of course, but...
wow.
Sponsor me, you cowards.
And Mike
Nichols,
1988 film.
All right, guys, I'll let you go, but thanks again so much for this, and congrats on Last Night in Soho.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demek. This is normally where we leave you, but today we thought you might appreciate a bonus sneak preview of our upcoming sister show. How I Write, presented by Arc Studio Pro, launches on Friday, November 12th. Click the link in today's show notes to find out more. Hope you enjoy.
A big part of my process is I work in 15-minute chunks. I set a timer and I write for 15 minutes. And when that timer goes off, I stop. What I do is I give myself little mini breaks, and it allows me a chance to kind of refresh and regroup. And 2 or 3 minutes later, I'll just go right back into it and do another 15 minutes. The work seems much more manageable when I break it up into small little chunks. There's no way I think I could ever write a screenplay if I thought I had to do it. But if you told me to write a screenplay for 15 minutes, I'll do it easily. For me, discipline comes 15 minutes at a time, because I can't handle discipline beyond 15 minutes, but I can trick myself.
That's Will Collins, a screenwriter from Donegal, Ireland, who last year wrote his way to an Oscar nomination, 1/4 of an hour burst of creativity at a time. If you saw Wolfwalkers, the gripping and beautiful story of a girl in 17th century Ireland who befriends a tribe of magical wolves, you'll know all about Will's timeless storytelling style, blending dreamlike fantasy with grounded emotion and coming-of-age introspection. What you might not know about him is, everything Will does, he approaches in 15-minute chunks, whether that's scene work, character creation, or a ritual he does every morning to get his creativity flowing.
I try to, you know, plug in a 15-minute slot in the morning where I would just free write for 15 minutes, and I would start a story just as a prose. The next morning I would come back and I would continue that story for 15 minutes, And I would do it again the third day and the fourth day and the fifth day. And by the end of the 5 days, I would have a little weird short story written, just all in 15-minute chunks. It would be completely weird, but it was a great creative exercise just to, I suppose, mine whatever was going on in my subconscious and let it pour out. And sometimes in those little quiet moments, some gems can be found there as well, you know. So yeah, the mini sprints, that's how I survive.
I'm Al Horner, and coming up on How I Write, a podcast about the highs, lows, and workflows of screenwriting, Will Collins explains why his best work often comes in those bleary-eyed moments right after he's woken up. We also talk about the trick he stole from Stephen King that unlocked a new way of working for him, the single post-it note that keeps him on track in his storytelling, and how a movie like Wolfwalkers is written, from outline to finish line.
Invariably, when I get to the end, I visualize myself as a marathon runner crossing that tape on the finish line, and I collapse. I collapse on right onto the track. I don't even use my hands to protect myself when I fall. I'm just scraped and I'm bruised.
That's all to come today on How I Write, presented by Arc Studio Pro, the screenwriting software that lets writers stay focused on the stories they're trying to tell on the page. Get your free trial today to check out its intuitive design, seamless real-time collaboration, excellent outlining functions, and easy-to-use import and export capabilities. More on those guys later, but now, with no further ado...
I'm Will Collins, and this is How I Write. I love writing animation because you can let your imagination go wild. In the case of Wolfwalkers, never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine I'd be writing an action-adventure, coming-of-age, gothic horror film set in 1650 Ireland, and for it to be realised in such a dramatic way.
Dramatic is one way of putting it. How else would you describe the way that Wolfwalkers wowed the world in 2020, becoming an against-the-odds rival to Pixar's Soul and Onward for Best Picture at the most recent Academy Awards? Directed by Tom Moore and Ross Stewart, the film from Irish studio Cartoon Saloon benefited from a magical screenplay in which, as Will explains, he was able to let his imagination flow almost completely unrestricted. But how do you begin writing a movie like Wolfwalkers? What are the practical steps, the daily routine that Will takes when he sits down to write a new script?
I think the time just before you go to sleep and the time just after you wake up are these two magical twilight hours where your subconscious is completely awake and your adult logical mind is kind of going to sleep. That's also where the devil can do his dangerous things and kind of put crazy thoughts into your heads. But sometimes if you're lucky and you're a creative person, I know I'm quite often preoccupied by story problems. So what I do is before, if I'm really stuck on something, I will make sure it's the last thing I think about before I go to sleep. And I'll really concentrate on a specific story problem. And I make sure when I get up in the morning, I try and focus on that problem and see what comes out. And I just let a certain degree of free flow happen. And usually I come up with some interesting ideas. I'll definitely come up with one solution. It might not be the right solution, but there's something magical that happens at night where you're brain is still kicking over and kind of trying to solve these problems that produces some sort of solutions the next morning. So yeah, for me, the early hours are particularly important for me.